Welcome to the Doggy Dojo Podcast. I'm your host, Susan Light, a Los Angeles-based dog trainer and behavior consultant on a quest to become worthy of the title Sensei of the Doggy Dojo. Today, we're talking about one of the OG topics related to dog training, dominance theory and alphas. Why is this important? Because it has shaped the way that people have approached dogs for decades, and not in a positive way. The science is actually very clear for those who take the time to look into it, but the noise around this topic has led to so many misconceptions and misunderstandings. I've certainly touched on this topic in previous episodes. I think it's really important, but it's still coming up so often that I thought it was time to devote an entire episode. My guest is a certified applied animal behaviorist and certified professional dog trainer. She has her Master of Science and PhD, specializing in the areas of ethology, which is the science of animal behavior, animal welfare, and epidemiology. Please welcome Dr. Janet Cutler. Janet, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So we're going to talk about a hot topic in dog training today, dominance theory. Let's start with defining it. What is dominance theory and why are we talking about it with dog training?
Sure. So I think I'll start first with what dominance is. So really what that is a relationship between two animals. And in that, one animal gets access to whatever they consider an important resource. And this is developed over a period of time where they've used aggression or force or something like that over multiple events. And the other animal submits or defers or gives them whatever it is that they're looking for. So dominance theory is really kind of using that definition of dominance. It's a lay theory that was developed that is used to talk about kind of how dogs act or how other animals act too. Dominance can happen in a whole range of species as well. And this relationship, it can really change depending on the resources that they're maybe fighting over, the age of the animal, their health, their reproductive status, the environment that they're in. There's a whole bunch of different things that can really affect that relationship between them.
Sure. And how do people apply that to dog training?
Well, they apply it in a lot of different ways. So I guess the idea that aggression or force is used in order to protect a resource, it can be sometimes used in training through aversive tools and methods and kind of instances where force would be used and fear or submission, on the other hand, to ensure that a dog is kind of maintaining their rank or doing the things that a person might want them to do.
Yeah. So this idea that you have to be dominant over your dog, that they have to know you're the quote unquote boss or the alpha.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. So let's talk about, from my understanding, and this is why I love bringing on people who know more than I do, but my understanding is this basically originated in a study of a wolf pack. And I'd love to talk about that study some more.
For sure. So there was a study that was done. It was published in the 40s, and it was a long period of time where Rudolf Schenkel observed wolves, and he described all kinds of behavior in the wolves. But the part that was really interesting when it comes to this theory is the social behavior between the different wolves. And in it, what he described was a hierarchy where there was an alpha, a beta, etc. And the alphas in this group of wolves had to defend their position in the group. And he kind of described a whole bunch of behaviors where they were really acting forceful or aggressive or threatening towards the other wolves in order to maintain their status, in order to get different resources, all those kinds of things. And this was done in a group of wolves that were not related to one another, and they were confined in a really small area. So it's very different from what we would see in a normal wolf pack.
It was a zoo, right?
Yeah, it was an old zoological society. I was trying to find some information really about a bit more of a description of what it looked like, but they do describe kind of an enclosure in one area, and it's 200 meters squared. So it's a really small area for a group of wolves.
How many wolves were in the group? Do you know offhand?
I don't remember how many there were.
When I'm trying to think about like small in that space, like how many they put in there. Interesting. So they fought for dominance, quote unquote. They had to use aggression to maintain their position in their hierarchy. The 1940s, that's like 80 years ago.
It is. So part of the problem, though, with this research was David Meach, who wrote a really, really popular book, used that data when he was talking about social behavior of wolves. And this book went on to sell many, many, many copies. And he really popularized kind of this idea that wasn't necessarily very popular ahead of time, but it was because of that book that it became kind of a bit more widespread. Since then, he has actually retracted kind of what he wrote and what he said, and asked the publishers to stop publishing that book because he did a bunch of work afterwards and found a very different hierarchy within the wolves.
Yeah, and this is what I think is so interesting is like, this is 80 years ago, but well, faster than that. Science moved on. We're still learning. We're still studying, right? And he's like, whoa, this isn't right. And everybody's still stuck. This book, from my understanding, still in print.
It's out there. They stopped publishing it last year, the year before, I believe. But there's definitely many copies out there. Yes.
Because I had heard that he asked them to stop publishing it and they didn't. So
exactly.
Yeah, so we have this like frozen in a piece of time piece of science that people have hung so many things on that have not evolved and moved as the science has moved along. And that's what just blows my mind about this industry sometimes.
But why? It is hard to believe.
Why do we use this study for dogs anyway? Wolves aren't dogs, right?
Yes, absolutely. So dogs are descendants of wolves, but they've been domesticated for thousands of years. They're behaviorally different, they're genetically different, and we as people have really been selecting for a lot of different behaviors, different appearances in our dogs. So there's been a lot of changes, but that's not to say that many of their behaviors aren't the same. I mean, we can still see a lot of the same body language, those kinds of things, but they aren't necessarily acting in the same way, they aren't acting for the same reasons that wolves might be. And then in our household dogs, I mean, we provide pretty much all the resources they need for survival, whereas wolves would be having to compete for that. Most of our dogs aren't trying to produce offspring, so they're not competing for that. So there's a lot of differences in kind of their motivations, their requirements, all those kinds of things that don't apply to wolves.
Yeah. But is it inherently the thing that I think people get stuck with is they're like, oh, genetically somewhere in there, the wolf is still in there and we have to dominate it. So it doesn't, I mean, these are things people say to me, you know, someone actually said you have to, they have to believe you can dominate them or they'll bite you. And I was like, that's not correct.
It's not. And if you look at more recent science on wolf behavior, even, it's very different. So when I said Meach had done further research, he went out and in nature watched a couple wolf packs and really watched a whole bunch of individuals and kind of how they maintained their pack. And it is very, very different. So in a typical wolf pack in nature, it's a smaller group and there's a breeding pair at the top. And it's their offspring that are in their pack with them. So there's really this automatic hierarchy because they're the parents and they've got the offspring. And there's very little aggression or anything like that that happens in that. It's kind of just an age-based order. And as the young and the offspring get older, they disperse and they leave the pack and they go off and create their own packs. And that's something that couldn't happen in that captive group of wolves because there wasn't the room for them to disperse. And there's a lot of other differences. Like in those packs, instead of the like quote unquote alpha or the dominant adult male getting the food first, it's actually the youngest pups that get the food first. They're fed preferentially. And a lot of the kind of the social order that was described as through aggressive kind of events, those kinds of things don't happen in that family group. It's more the submissive behaviors that you see. So you'll see like crouching or licking another dog's face or those kinds of behaviors and not those overt aggressive behaviors. So that's actually what happens in a typical wolf pack. And it's not what a lot of people have in their minds of what happens in wolves even.
Yeah, it's so true. It's just a family. And then exactly. Even when, let's say, one of the male offspring in the family grows up and wants their own pack, my understanding is they don't then fight their dad for that pack. They just go and find a mate and start their own pack.
Exactly. And I mean, if you look at evolution, it wouldn't make sense for them to try to mate with their mother, right? they're trying True. To go off and find other individuals, ideally less related individuals, so that their offspring have a better chance of survival. Yeah. So they are not fighting their father. Yeah, that's not
so Oedipal. I hadn't thought about that part of it. That's so funny. Yeah. So it just kind of seems ridiculous that we're using this in this day and age to determine how we treat our dogs.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, even there's been some groups that have been studied where it's kind of multiple families together. But even in that situation where potentially there could be those fights, there really often aren't many of them. So that idea that we really have to exude this dominance or whatever that kind of theory isn't accurate. If you want to relate them back to wolves, isn't accurate there.
Crazy. And also, I know this is a little bit off topic and we hadn't planned to talk about this, but I think that's because aggression is very costly behavior.
Absolutely.
So generally, they're going to try to avoid it and work out the issues with as little or no aggression as possible. They don't have this like knee-jerk aggression desire. It's not functional in nature.
Absolutely. Yeah. In kind of across the board in species, aggressive events, I mean, they do happen, of course, but they aren't something that majority of animals are outright trying to get into because they could get injured, they could die. So they want to avoid those at all costs.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. So what else have we learned since this study? You said he kept studying that those natural packs. Are people still studying this, or has science pretty much said, we figured that out 50 years ago and we're on to other things right now?
There's still research going on in wolves. I'm not sure if they're looking at kind of the social structure in particular, but there's absolutely a lot of wolf research that's still going on. It's a really interesting topic. And there are many things that can relate back to our dogs. There is a wolf research center, and kind of a lot of different work is going into this. But in general, in wolves in particular, I think they've kind of, for the most part, figured out how those structures work within them. There has been some work in feral dogs and kind of other groups of dogs as well that aren't necessarily our household dog. But really, the majority of the research that I've seen at the moment is more focused on kind of the dogs in our households, behavior problems we're seeing, our training methods, and how we're working with them.
Yeah, I love that. I love that we're finally actually going straight to the source and doing, you know, some apples for apples research. And what do these studies tell us, the most up-to-date science, about how we should be approaching dog training? What methods should we be using?
So on the whole, I mean, if you're looking at kind of the traditional training methods or those methods that rely on dominance, so kind of we talked about it briefly at the beginning, but the theory behind this is really that people should be dominant over the dog to prevent kind of any disobedience from the dog or aggression from the dog, and they have in order to have a well-behaved dog. But what happens when you kind of have that dominance mindset almost going into training is oftentimes people will misinterpret the motivation that the dog has. So in a lot of these cases, people believe or have heard that the dog's motivation is to be dominant. And it's not really a personality trait of a dog. It's not their motivation. It's just that definition that I gave at the beginning, where they have kind of won several events that have been over some kind of a resource. So the problem with kind of these methods is that they end up being more confrontational or using more aversive type of techniques when they're doing training, when they're doing behavior modification. And what the science is saying is that the use of positive reinforcement, so instead of using that dominance mindset, but giving kind of treats or praise or play or something like that in order to increase the behavior we want, leads to less fear, leads to less aggression, creates a better human-animal bond than those other methods.
Absolutely, 100%. And creates the word that I think a lot of us use is less risk for fallout, right?
So yes, fallout is definitely something can happen when you use those types of methods. And there's a few other concerns that can come along with that. So in addition to fallout, we can see that dogs may sometimes react defensively to using those types of tools or those types of methods. And when someone is kind of coming from a dominance mindset, that can look like the dog is not listening to them or not behaving in the manner they'd like. They're behaving aggressively. So sometimes that can lead to the use of increasingly stronger methods to make sure that the person is kind of quote unquote winning the encounter and not the dog. The other really big concern I have with those types of methods is you're not working on the underlying emotion that's causing the behavior to start with. So a lot of times those tools can be used to stop a behavior. We can definitely get that fallout. Sometimes they just stop the behavior, but the reasons that the dog is behaving that way are still there and you haven't worked on it. So eventually at some point or time, it's going to come out. And for the meantime, the welfare, the well-being of that dog can be really, really compromised. So when we're working with kind of desensitization and counter conditioning, those types of tools, we're really working on that emotion that's driving the behavior.
Dr. Cutler helps people with dog and cat behavior problems with virtual consultations to develop personalized behavior modification and training programs to suit the household and the pet. She is a fear-free certified professional. If you'd like to find her, she's on Instagram at janethcutler.phd and her Facebook page is Landmark Behavior Inc. You can check out the Landmark Behavior blog, and if you'd like a bit more of the technical science, check out the Behaviory podcast. I've linked them all for you in the show notes. We'll be right back. Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. And I think that it's a real human construct. We want to sort of make our dogs quote unquote good. And we also, I think we get a lot of pride from our dogs behaving well. It's like this flex, mm-hmm. right? It's like, oh, watch my dog come or drop it. Or when I just sort of like say no or whatever, like this control over this other being makes us feel powerful mm-hmm. and like we're awesome or we did something right. It's like this accomplishment that our dog is well behaved. Or I'm sure people do it with their children too. But the thing that you forget is like humans have morality and dogs mm-hmm. don't. There's no good, you know, there's behavior. There's only behavior and behavior has function. And that's another like construct that we have to sort of break out of while we're breaking out of this dominance theory too, is like, we don't need to dominate them and make them good.
Yeah.
You know, we need to make them feel safe and maybe show them what we'd rather have them do than others and motivate them because they're animals. They don't have the same motivation that we do. But yeah, I think those are two really big mindset shifts and they kind of go hand in
hand.
They
do, for sure. And it's also remembering that they aren't motivated by trying to dominate the person. There's, you know, other motivations going on in the dog. Maybe they're hungry. Maybe they want to chase that squirrel. Maybe something has worked in the past, so they're trying it again, but they're not doing it because they want to be exerting control over you. And it's really, like you mentioned, that mindset shift of kind of thinking about why they're doing something, what might be driving that, and kind of checking our own assumptions about why they're doing that before we react.
100%. And let's go back to this word alpha, because I was going to, you know, ask, was there no alpha in the study? You were saying there was an alpha in the study. So a couple of these words that maybe aren't totally incorrect when people are like, oh, a pack, an alpha, et cetera, et cetera, to me have been really poisoned. I kind of like knee jerk, don't say those words. But they're not necessarily bad. Can you add a little nuance to the idea of alpha and what they what they meant.
Yeah.
Even though maybe our dogs are not trying to dominate
us. For sure. So really it was just a term that they gave because alpha is the first letter in the alphabet to the wolf who seemed to kind of be in charge in that situation. So in that original research, what they were doing was they were just giving them labels for kind of their position in that hierarchy, in that really unusual grouping of wolves. And that's kind of been used since then. Now, it has really been popularized in media. And kind of that's where the whole dominance theory gained its popularity and really talking about alphas. And while, yes, it is a term that was used oftentimes now in research and in kind of other areas, they're talking more about the dominant breeding pair or just the breeding pair, because that is really why they're kind of on the top of the hierarchies, because those are the ones breeding. They're the older kind of parents of the younger ones in that group.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that it's one of those things. It's like, if someone says alpha, I'm like, no, because we've sort of spoiled that. And I think pack too, when people are like my pack, I also have a knee jerk reaction, because I think my understanding is that now we understand dogs are not pack animals, but we've seen that they're social.
Yeah. So the feral dogs that they've studied seem to form these kind of fluid groups where they will gather for a period of time, but they don't seem to stay consistent over time. And a lot of times they're foraging for food, those kinds of things that they do individually or maybe with one other dog. So we're really not seeing that development of kind of a pack structure for the most part in those dogs either.
Absolutely. That's what I understood. So, and then I think people have argued about whether they're den animals either, you know, usually comes up in crate training. They're like, oh, they love the crate because they're den animals. My understanding is dogs are not naturally den animals either. It doesn't mean I'm opposed to creating positive associations in the crate and having your dogs be crate trained. It just means they need to be crate trained. They're not just going to take to it automatically because they're quote unquote den animals.
Yeah, I mean, from what I understand, they do have a den, but just when they've got young pups. So they need a safe spot that they can go with their pups. And I mean, maybe that's kind of a source of comfort for younger animals as they grow up. I don't really know. I think it's a bit of a stretch to, I mean, I fully support crate training. I crate train my own dogs and I recommend it to many, many people. I think it's a bit of a stretch to say it's similar to a den, because there's so many other things that would go along with that in kind of natural behavior out in the wild.
Yeah. And let's face it, us having pet dogs is not anything like wolves in nature. It's like you said, it's like, no. We've selected for them, we've domesticated them, we've created their whole environment, that it really doesn't make sense why sometimes we're trying to be like, oh, the wolf pack, blah blah blah. It's like, that has nothing to do with it. It really doesn't.
Yeah, and I mean, it really doesn't. Dogs are not trying to access a lot of the resource that is the main priority of an animal out in nature. And we just give them that. So they have different motivations. They have different priorities than an animal would out in the wild.
So what are the priorities that our pet dogs have?
So I think, it's very obviously dependent on the individual, but they can have priorities to spend time with their people. They may really be a social dog that likes those interactions. They may be a dog that loves to go out and go for a walk and sniff around for an hour. So really, depending on what their individual preferences are, they're likely going to work to try to get that from us. They may be a dog that really loves to just hang out all day on the couch and rest. And that's totally fine, but that's their priority. So there's just such a wide range in our pet dogs because they have the opportunity to have those individual kind of variations and desires that a wolf in the wild wouldn't really ever be able to consider because they're so focused on getting food, getting safety, all those kinds of things.
That is awesome. I think that we've covered all of the questions that I had. Was there anything else that you wanted to, while you have this chance, while we're talking about dominance theory, anything that you'd like to make sure people hear?
There is. I did want to bring up some research that's kind of just starting right now, though, that I think is really interesting when we're looking at this whole concept. And it's on the psychology side. So it's looking at the human side of this. But there's some really interesting work that's looking at the association between men and masculinity and their beliefs about dominance in dogs. Because what we've seen across a wide range of research in training methodologies is that men are more likely to use aversives than women, that's not a blanket statement by any means, but on the whole, they are. And it looks like from some of the preliminary research I've seen, and again, none of this is published yet, it's just kind of being completed. But there is this association between traditional masculine kind of ideals and their belief in dominance theory and the use of kind of that theory when working with dogs. So I think that's really interesting. And I think having the human component to this is going to help answer a lot of these questions about why it became so popular and why people are really clinging on to this theory when the science is kind of pointing in the opposite direction.
Yeah, and has been for so long. Mm-hmm. For so long.
Yeah, it's something that people are really, really clinging hard to. So hopefully some of that research is going to help and maybe find ways to educate people about the science and how maybe we could be changing how we view our relationship with dogs. Because I think really when it comes down to it, all of this is about how we're dealing with our relationship with our dogs.
100%. Absolutely. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on and talking about this today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for stopping by the dojo this week. This is your aspiring sensei, Susan Light, signing off. You can find me at doggydojopodcast.com or I'm Susan Light LA on Instagram, Pinterest, and Facebook. The music was written by Mac Light. You can find him at maclightsongwriter.com. If you like the show, you can support it by subscribing, sharing it with your friends, rating it, and reviewing it on Apple Podcasts. Just a reminder, this podcast is intended for educational purposes only and does not constitute advice or professional services by either the host or any of the guests. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another new episode of the Doggy Dojo.